Hi, I'm John Ostrander, and this is Spoiler Country.
Hey, hey, people of Earth, it's time to enter the Spoilerverse via our secret portal at the exclusive Arctic Club in beautiful downtown Seattle with our hosts, John and Kenrick and Casey. Welcome to Spoiler Country!
Hey, if you're listening to our show for the first time and you're on one of the social medias that we're on, like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, any of those kinds of things, you should always check us out on Spoilerverse.com. But if you want to keep up with our latest episodes, you should bring out your smartphone, get into your favorite podcatcher, find Spoiler Country, and hit subscribe. Then you'll get all our new stuff.
And if you want to reach out to us, you can do that in two ways. You can call us, leave us a voicemail at 707-656-2080. Again, 707-656-2080. Or you can shoot us an email at spoilercountry@gmail.com. A beer, sit down, take a drink, and welcome back to Spoiler Country. I am Johnny Horsley, or John Horsley, or JN, or Jay, or whatever name you want to call me. I don't really care. Just pick one. Probably just John works fine, or Johnny's good too. But today on the show, we got John Ostrander, who is one of the brilliant minds behind the original Suicide Squad series from the 80s. And by original, I mean the one that I grew up with. I know there was one before that, but the one with him and Carl Kessel worked on that as well and created the logo for it, the inspiration for the new movie. John's also done a lot more stuff, but Suicide Squad is like one of my favorite things that he worked on. And we got a chance to sit down and chat with him about his career and about the Suicide Squad and about a bunch of stuff. And I don't really want to sit and waste a lot of your time. I was on this interview with Casey, but I ended up having to drop out about halfway through for kid stuff. But Casey does a fantastic job. You're going to love it. So here, in his own words, is John Ostrander.
All right, everybody, welcome again to another episode of Spoiler Country. Today on the show, we have legendary writer John Ostrander. John Ostrander he's written the roadmap for many of the characters that you know and love today, specifically and coming up in the future, Suicide Squad. He really got that ball rolling, created the team, and we want to pick his brain about it a little bit. So, John, how you doing, buddy?
I'm all right. How are y'all doing down there?
We're good. And other John is actually in Washington State. So
other John, I'm in Seattle.
he's one of those.
But I'm doing good up here. It's actually a nice, warm, beautiful day up here. So it's not raining as it was for a few days in a row here.
You got any fires out there, or are those
we got
fires somewhere else?
They're all around us. So there's none where I'm at because I'm in the Seattle area, King County. There's no fires, but we've got the smoke. The smoke's cleared up now. We had about a good week where we couldn't really go outside because it was. It looked like a doomsday because everything was covered in smoke and the sun was like orangish red and it was kind of creepy.
I know, that's just a nightmare thing that I could scarcely envision. And I envision a lot of nightmare things.
It is. It was weird. I have 5 kids and I've got a 6-year-old, almost 7. And he was, the smoke came out and he like, as soon as we told him what was going on, he wouldn't let anybody go outside. He was like, no, you can't go outside. The smoke's going to get you. And every day he's like, Dad, is the smoke cleared? Can we go play outside yet? It was heartbreaking, but at least he was, you know, knowledgeable of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So
as long as you're staying safe.
Yeah, staying safe for sure.
So you I notice a trend with a few of the writers we've talked to lately in that oddly they have a theater background. Why do you think that is?
Well, the thing about there is a lot of similarity, I think, between comic book writing and theater, particularly write for the theater, but even if you are doing something else in the theater. In theater, a lot of action and characterization is conveyed through the dialogue. We all know how important the dialogue is in terms of the comics. Also, it's very good in terms of teaching structure. You know, there's a 3 or 5 act setup, sometimes it's a 1 act, and it all leads up to a climax and then denouement. So the structure of theater is very similar to what you need, well, telling stories in general, but I think also for comics.
It's so crazy. I was reading about your background, and you were a member of the Chicago scene when theater was really taking off there in the 70s.
Yeah.
What was that like? And did you know you were a part of something that was really special?
You could feel it at the time. You know, there's a certain rebellious attitude to it. There was also a found quality to it in that you found different spaces that weren't usually theater spaces. They weren't established theater buildings. And so you would create a space there, and then you would create the sort of theater that you wanted to do. Now, you already had Second City, which was a very different form of theater. And then Paul Sills, who helped create Second City, also brought in his story theater, which was another rather different way of doing theater. So, and I think still too, Chicago is a hotbed for people. There's something of the Mickey Rooney attitude there. come on, kids, let's put on a show. You know, I was sort of like that when I was running my own theater company very badly. But yeah, it was exciting. The people who were working at that time or just starting off went on to become notable, huge successes. David Mamet, the playwright, started off in Chicago.
Nobody. Never heard of him. Yeah.
John Malkovich, Gary Sinise.
I was about to ask about Steppenwolf.
Yeah, I never worked with Steppenwolf, although I did work with the Organic Theater. Stuart had Joe Mantegna with it, Keith Sarabica. Oh, God, so many others.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and of course, the most established theater there at the time was the Goodman Theater. And the Goodman even underwent sort of a shakeup as the front there influenced more and more people in the Chicago area, more and more that theater itself. Still had the Schubert, which was, of course, the home for, you know, stage traveling companies to come in, you know, road shows, various Broadway hits, but they didn't have much organically to do with Chicago. And these other companies certainly did. They reflected a certain Chicago attitude of, come on, let's get together. Don't make a big deal. Let's do the job and have some fun.
That's awesome. What was it like working with Del Close? I'm assuming you started writing with him in comics because you met him via the theater scene.
Right. Right. We were both in Christmas Carol.
Oh, together. Nice.
He played the ghost of Christmas. And the first year of the show, I was assigned a dressing room with him. And of course, I knew about Del, but the things I'd heard about Del were could be a little fearsome. But he turned out to be just the nicest guy, hugely, hugely informed about science fiction and fantasy. He regarded comic books as the American art form that had not really yet taken off, and so there's in it. So he was a big fan of comics. And so from that, we just became more acquainted. When my character Grimm went into his own book, they wanted a backup feature. And I suggested to Mike Gold, who was the editor and my good buddy, that we do an anthology series based on Munden Spar, which was where Grimjack worked out of. The only trick being is that a different writer and artist, and that Jack, you'd have to be the bar, you know, and at some point, some of the action had to touch on the bar, but didn't have to stay there strictly. It could be in Sinister. And Mike was going, I don't know. You know, anthologies are hard to do. You got to keep on bringing people in. I said, well, I could do, like a lot of them. I could be the standard one. And going, I don't know, you're busy. I said, and I know Del Close.
That's so awesome. That's
when Mike hit the brakes, he went, Del Close, because Mike knew certainly who Del Close was. And he went, and the idea of Del Close and his way of thinking, winding up in comics, doing some comics together. And I said, no, he loves the idea of comics. He's never written them. And I could help provide the structure, and you know, Del helps provide the ideas, and we do the stories together. And that's what sold it. I sold Mike on the basis that Del Close would be working with me.
That's amazing. So I had the same reaction of Del Close writing comics with you that I did when I found out that Werner Herzog likes professional wrestling. I was like, that is amazing. I would have never expected it, but I love every second of it.
Yeah. People are people, you know, and you'll find that they all like different things. Dell and I got to be really good friends, and I wound up inviting him to my wedding to Kim Yale, but not without being a little bit nervous, because Dell could be unpredictable. And everyone who knew Dell knew a dozen Dell stories. You know, like I've got five or six of them at hand, but you never knew what he might do. And so I was worried, you know, like he would come out on the receiving line and say to my mother, "Oh, so glad that John has gotten married. The animals at Lincoln Park Zoo will be less nervous." But no, he was perfectly charming. He was just delighted to be invited. And he and his partner, Sharna Halpern, she was his date that day. And he was just so pleased to be invited to the wedding because he was my writing partner. And so he was charming throughout the entire thing.
That's awesome. I was wondering, you brought it up a little bit earlier about how three-act structure and everything kind of plays into, is kind of similar between comics and playwriting and theater. What else did you take over from the theater scene to your work in comics?
The idea that it's not just you are working with a bunch of people, and you better be respectful of everything that everyone brings to it. And I'm not talking just about the penciler or the inker. I'm also including the letterer. I'm including the colorist. I'm including the production staff. I'm including the editor, assistant editors, you know, all the way around. You better be respectful of what everyone brings to the party, because otherwise you'll wind up looking like a damn fool. I guarantee it.
That's the collaborative aspect of comics is huge.
The collaborative.
So did you go from seminary to theater, or what was the basis of that?
Well, okay. First of all, sometimes some people have made a bigger thing about my being in the seminary than probably was true. I went to Quigley Preparatory Seminary North, which was basically a high school.
Oh, okay.
And I went there for 1 year, for my freshman year. As I semi-jokingly say, I joined the seminary because I had an overdose of Going My Way. And not the movie. There was a TV series of it for about a season and a half, maybe two seasons, that starred Gene Kelly and Leo G. Carroll in the parts made famous by Bing Crosby and Barry Fitzgerald. And like many Catholic kids, you know, you get sort of into the almost romance idea of being a priest. And so I went in, and it was okay. I enjoyed the school a lot, but along the way I discovered girls, and dating was discouraged at the seminary. So I left there and moved over to Loyola Academy. Now, once I was there, as I've told the story somewhere elsewhere, there's another. Now, Loyola at the time, especially, was an all boys high school. There were other Catholic schools, and some of them were all girls schools. And one was Maryville, which is no longer around. And I had sort of a crush on a girl who was at Maryville. And I had learned that they needed, being an all-girls school, if they're going to do a play, they needed guys to come in. So I said, all right, I'll go in and try out. And I got my friend Rick Reinders to give me a lift and to try out with me. And I got as far as the front door, and I almost chickened out because I got cold feet. And he said, "No, no, 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 no. You're going in. You brought me this far. We're going in." So we did. And because there weren't many guys auditioning, I got my first part. And I never did see the girl I had a crush on, but I got a new crush, which was theater and acting along the way, thanks to the director, Mary Gavin Crawford, who I really credit with getting me started in theater. And so that was my sophomore year. And I did plays there every year, and I also did them at my school as well. And then when I graduated, I went to Loyola University, and I was part of the theater there from the beginning. I had decided this is what I want to do.
Well, how did your parents take that? Because
actually, my mother was very supportive, in particular because she had been in community theater before she was married, and she had to give that up when she got married. But she was always very supportive of any of us who wanted to do anything in the arts. She was just, she was supportive in general, but she was very supportive, particularly of our wanting to do the arts, because there was part of her heart that was still in that. So, and particularly going into theater, which is where she had been, she was very supportive of it. My dad was also, you know, basically whatever I wanted to do. You know, they came to the first show that I did, again at Marywood. And afterward, my brother Joe, my twin brother Joe, when I came out to see the family, he blurted out, you know, you were good. Mom told us to say you were good, even if you weren't, but you really were good.
So when I was reading your background, it made me think, like, don't worry, Mom, if this whole theater thing doesn't pan out, I got to back up. I'm going to write comics.
No, actually, that wasn't true, to find a backup career, but she was thinking of teaching or something like that. And I resisted it entirely because I said, you know, if I have a fallback career, I'm going to fall back on it. I want to do this without a net. You know, I cannot have anything else. But I was a big fan of comics at that point, you know, and particularly when I was at Loyola University and in my theater days. This was a glorious period, particularly for Marvel Comics, when you had a lot of very exciting things happening and a lot of very exciting people working there. Jim Steranko was work then. There's Doctor Strange. There was, of course, Jack Kirby, King Kirby, and Stan Lee and John Buscema and Roy Thomas and everyone at the top of their games. And it was very exciting. In fact, it was a Marvel comic. It was a Fantastic Four that taught me what a cliffhanger should be. And it was a Fantastic Four. They had all gone into the negative zone. They had barely made it back out. But Reed had sacrificed himself along the way, and he was drifting towards the exploding zone at the center. And that's where they left the book. You know, he was falling towards that, and there was no hope of getting him out. And I wanted that next issue right then in my hand so I could find out. And that's what taught me. It's what I always try to do when I do a continued story, is I want you to want that next issue in your hands right then.
That's awesome. I was thinking about around the time that you had really started getting into comics, Jerry Conway was also at Marvel, and he was, I'm sure, writing some of the comics that you were reading. And then later on, you when you start at DC, you write Firestorm after he leaves the book. How was that, taking up after somebody I'm sure you respected quite a bit?
Yeah, actually, I think Firestorm was the first regular book that I was offered. I was doing Legends at the time. Again, my buddy Mike Gold had left First Comics and was now over at DC Comics, and he wanted me along for the ride as well. So I plotted Legends, which Len Wein then scripted. And because Jerry didn't want to get involved with this big crossover thing, yeah, you know, he was basically sort of, you know, taking the exit by then. And so they decided to give me a shot at Firestorm. And because they knew I knew what Legends was about, so they asked me to do the tie-in issue to it. And I did that. And then, like an issue or two after I did that, they offered me the gig on a regular basis, and became the first regular series that I did at DC.
That's awesome. Were you ever worried about stepping on anybody's toes, especially taking over a character that I think Jerry created that character, right?
So, oh yeah. Yeah. Also, even early on in my career, back at First Comics, even before Grimjack came out, I was offered to take over a Star Slayer, which Mike Grell had brought over with him as well. And that was, I had done only about 4 or 5 8-page backups by that point. So this was now going to be a full book. And Mike was famous for, he once, you know, as the story goes, he once came into negotiations with a briefcase, opened it up, took a Magnum handgun out, put it on the table and said, let's talk.
So, and you don't mess with him.
No. Even Gold told me, he says, now do this right, because I don't want Grell killing you. I mean, Mike Grell has, or at least did at the time, he had more guns than some third world nations. You know, like, so.
Sounds like my in-laws. Oh my God.
Well, and this is the guy who was writing John Sable Freelance. So, I got to do that, and he didn't kill me, so I guess I was doing okay. But they needed a backup for it, and that's where Grimjack fit in.
So the thing that that I was wondering, how does a nice Catholic boy like you come up with Grimjack?
Well, I don't know if I'm that nice a Catholic boy. But if you're Catholic, I mean, you know all sorts of things about sin and retribution, vengeance. You know, the Bible's full of that stuff, you know, and so long as you don't take it too seriously. And that's a joke. That's a joke. Well, sort of a joke. Don't forget, I was in seminary, and so that took some of the gloss off. But what Grimjack came out of really was my love for what I call narrative alloys. I like to take bits from this genre and bits from that genre, and then blend them together to make an alloy. For instance, Sword and Sorcery, like Conan, came out when Robert E. Howard took two different story things, a supernatural horror and what they call sword and sandal fiction, and blended them together to make Sword and Sorcery. So I said, well, that's a really clever idea. So I took Sword and Sorcery, which I enjoyed, and Hard-Boiled Detectives, which I also really loved and still do, and I melded them together into what I call the Hard-Boiled Barbarian, and that was Grimjack. I actually originally wrote it to be a prose series. I even wrote one prose short story, and it was set in a future Chicago that had been through some very rough times, and society and civilization had sort of fallen apart. But the elements of Grimjack were there at the time. So so when I went to first at one point I knew they were looking for more properties, and so I said, well, I got this one, and I knew that they had Sinisher at that point. So I said, well, yeah, and they were going to just destroy it at the end of the first Warp special. And I said, no, this is a really good idea of a place where you can go anywhere else from. So I suggested that they save it, and they use Grimjack, and from there they said, well, tell you what, we'll try it in the back of Star Slayer for a couple of years. And if it takes on, well, then yeah, maybe he'll go into his own book. Grimjack was in his own book within 8 months of his first appearance.
That's amazing.
That's how quickly that he took off.
So is there still an effort to get that onto a TV show with Amazon?
Yeah. I'm not quite sure where it's at because, you know, COVID-19.
Yeah, everything's crazy.
Halt, but so far as I know, yeah, there's still plans, whether it's at Amazon or somewhere else, you know, to make it. A lot will depend upon what everyone decides their requirements are after all this pandemic has simmered down.
Oh yeah, I would love to see that in an episodic format, because I think it would be amazing.
Yeah, I think actually it would work better in an episodic format than it would really as a movie. In a movie, you got to make it sort of complete and in unto itself, whereas Grimjack always worked better, you know, like as we built things up layer by layer, issue by issue. Yeah. And I think we can do that better on television.
And it's such a big world, like a big sandbox to play in.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, so with your Catholic background, mm-hmm. and you kind of share similar politics, I think, with Denny O'Neill. Was that kind of like was there a comradeship in that? Did you guys kind of get along pretty well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I should say also that Denny was a big influence on me, particularly his Green Lantern, Green Arrow series. That introduced, now, Will Eisner also did this as well, and I met Will Eisner later on too, but it was more Green Lantern, Green Arrow that showed me that you could take contemporary social concerns and do them in comic book form. And I remember once Denny told me, you know, we were talking about a project, and he told me, you can say anything you want so long as you tell a story. If you want to preach, get a pulpit, but if you want to say something, you can, so long as first you tell people a story. That's the price of admission. And so he had a huge influence on me in terms of all of that. And yeah, and Denny and I got along terrifically, although he too, I was scared about meeting him because my first meeting was during a Chicago convention. And he and I were going to meet for the first time about Firestorm. And I would tell him some of my ideas for Firestorm. And I was going, what am I going to tell him? What can I tell Denny O'Neill that he hasn't already done, redone, and tossed away? So my gold, who knew Denny well, said, he's a vegetarian these days. Take him to a good vegetarian restaurant. And so there was one in Evanston, and I took him there. And so I sort of started telling him some of my ideas. He went, so I would go tell him this, this, and this, and go, yeah, that sounds good. What's good on the menu? And I said, well, I could, this. I said, and I could also do that, that, and that. And he said, yeah, that's okay. And I found out the Denny's basic attitude was, so long as I seemed to have an idea of what I wanted to do and where I was going, fine. He didn't want to be, you know, he didn't want to work that art. And by that, and I don't mean anything negative by that, is that if you knew what you were doing, he let you go off and do it. If you needed help, he was there for that too.
I've never heard a bad word said about the man in terms of how he worked with his creators. So yeah. I love hearing Denny O'Neill stories. Yeah. When you were on Firestorm, you kind of seamlessly, like you were talking about, story first, mm-hmm. no pulpit, but you kind of seamlessly added issues that were current to the day. Mm-hmm. And did you ever get any blowback from that? What did anybody ever give you any crap or editorial, especially?
Not editorial. And I think most of the fans were okay with it. I'm sure there were some who didn't care for the direction that I went. But basically, again, one of the things that I tend to do is I tend to take, okay, where are we? And so where do I go from here in such a way that it makes sense, but it's not predictable? For instance, when I was given it, Jerry Conway had left it so that Martin Stein, who was one half of a Firestorm, had an inoperable brain tumor. And so it was left to me to figure that out. And so at the time I decided he doesn't make it. We kill him off and bring someone else into the Matrix. Now, later on, I left a back door, as we call it, on it so that I could do something else with him. But yeah, basically, I changed the nature of Firestorm. But I simply followed through what the premise was at the time, that Martin Stein had an inoperable brain tumor that was going to kill him. I said, fine, we'll take it all the way there.
That's a ballsy move to basically kill off one half of the character.
Well, if you've watched my career, you know that I'm sometimes the Grim Reaper of comics.
So that being the case, was there any trepidation for you when, you know, you I guess press send isn't a thing back in the 80s when you wrote that, but when you turned in those pages, were you kind of biting your nails afterwards to see how it would be received?
No, actually I wasn't. I may be speaking just from the confidence of memory, but basically, maybe I got this from Denny. If I felt I knew what I was doing, I just said, well, let's go do it, you know, and it has to be a good story. And if it's a good story, I think you can justify almost anything.
That's awesome. I respect that confidence, because I am trying to write, and it can be hard sometimes to be confident in your ability as a young writer, especially. Was there anyone that kind of helped you along your way and kind of took you under their wing to show you the ropes when you moved into comics?
Well, when I first went into comics, for instance, I didn't know how to balloon a comic book page. And it was Joe Staton, who was the art director at the time. I mean, he was giving me hell because my balloons were all over the place. And he says, don't you know how to balloon a page? I said, no, no one's ever told me. So then he took pity on me and told me. There were other things, like Mike certainly gave me some advice, but I can give you some advice in terms of overall writing that I learned from a great man who was actually a theater teacher that I had for one semester back at Loyola University. They had a guest artist program at the time, and they had a teacher named Harold Lang who came in, who was just brilliant. I mean, I don't know if his movie career got him that far, but in terms of teaching, he taught me so much that still remains with me. Among other things, he conveyed his great passion and his enthusiasm, and he got you excited so that you wanted to please him so much and to learn so much. You couldn't learn enough. And one of the big things that he taught me was that you have the right to make a mistake. You have a right to try something and have it not work. You don't learn anything otherwise. You have to be willing to take a risk and just jump off the cliff. You'll survive, but if you're going to make a mistake, make a big one. if you don't make a big mistake, you can't see it. You won't learn anything from it. You know, and I've seen so many times, including in theater, in auditions, I used to see people come in, and particularly in the first audition, you know, it was the comeback or the callback that people wanted to make it to. But people were so afraid of making a fool of themselves or of doing something wrong that they didn't do anything. They were so cautious. And my suggestion is make a fool of yourself. You know, try something. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You'll get another chance. But don't inhibit yourself about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. Well, do you have any instances where you learn the hard lesson?
What, in terms of writing?
Yes, sir.
Well, okay. One of the things that I like and that happens fairly often is when the characters speak to you or tell you where the plot's going, if you're smart, you listen and you just do it. The two characters who most often spoke to me were John Gaunt, Grimjack, and Amanda Waller in Suicide Squad. All I had to do was, it seemed like, was to transcribe what I heard, you know, and to go in the direction that they want. Well, there was one issue of Grimjack, and I won't name it, but Gaunt didn't like it. He didn't like where the plot was going. And so I said, no, I'm the writer. This is where it's going. And he clammed up on me for the rest of the issue. It was the hardest issue I ever had to write because Gaunt just wouldn't talk to me about it. So that was a hard lesson to learn. You know, basically follow the characters. And if they go off somewhere from where your plan was, go with them. Don't stick so closely to your plot or to where you think it's going, and leave yourself open to where it might go.
So that obviously, like that, what do you do when they're not doing what you want to do? Like you just follow them, but how do you make them make the lemonade out of the lemons that you brought to the table after you screw it up with the characters?
Again, you just, in terms of plotting or figuring out where the story goes, you take a given point, you know, which may be the start of the idea for it. It's not necessarily the start of the plot, but, and you follow it, you know, what would be a reasonable extrapolation from this, and what would be what reasonably could have come before it, what came before it and what goes after it. And there's a whole bunch of possibilities that come along, and you follow the one that feels right to you. If you don't have that feeling, well, then you're in trouble. And maybe you want to find a different job, but, you follow where the story seems to want to go, where the characters want to go, and you listen to them. You listen, you know, and you combine things that you know are true, and your mind and your heart working together. It really is an act of creation. And in a way, you are like God. You're taking something that didn't exist before, except in your mind and your heart, and giving it a physical form. That's the other thing. If you got an idea, write it down. Put it into words, whether you type it on a computer screen or dictate it somewhere. I have journals that I have filled up over the years. Write it down, because you don't know what you got until you write it down. A question that I often ask when I do a seminar or something like that, and I've taught a bunch of these, the initial question always is, what does a writer do? And you tell me, what does a writer do?
To pull ideas out of the ether and put them on the page. But you have to have a little bit more than just slapping stuff down on the page. So I guess tell a story, right?
Interesting answer. Nothing what I was looking for. Don't complicate it. It's not a trick question. What does a writer do?
They write.
They write. A writer writes. If you want to be a writer, you have to write. Otherwise, you're a wannabe, but you have to. And if you're just getting started and you're going, well, I don't have time to write. You got 5 minutes every day, though. You have to spend 5 minutes a day, and you have to write it down. Don't tell it to somebody else, because if you do, you're letting the steam out of the engine. What you have to do is you have to put the words on a page somewhere, somehow. You know, once you do that, you don't know what you've got until you've written it down. And you want to do it every day, so that you get into the habit of writing. That's one thing. The other thing is, you know what Theodore Sturgeon, the famous science fiction writer, said when an interviewer said, what do you say to the accusation that some people make that 90% of all science fiction is crap? He shrugged and said, 90% of anything is crap. And a lot of, and more than 90%, particularly when you start writing, what you write is going to be crap. And the only way to improve is to write. You have to write the crap out of your system, you know, like, and just put it down. Don't edit it. Don't try to improve it. Take it, write it, put it down. I've got, oh God, I use a very small percentage of the plot plot ideas that I write down. Sometimes I write them down and I go, oh, well, that's not as good as I thought it was. And so I toss it, and so you toss it away and you never use it again. But in writing it down, I may find an element of it that I can use again.
So when you are writing, what do you have any particular habits that you try to keep? Like, do you write at night? Do you write in the morning? What is your method? Like, what works for you?
I get up, feed the cats, have breakfast, see what's going on in the world, and then sit down. And my butt's in the chair, you know, and the screen is on, and I work it from there. Now, sometimes I'll listen to music. Music helps feed me ideas.
Really?
Yeah. Sometimes it'll be, what I'm looking for is music that creates a feeling inside of me, or maybe I've got an idea for a scene. And particularly if I can find a piece of music, it'll help me form that idea into a scene. You know, it'll give me ideas of where to go. Especially, I prefer instrumental music, and classical can work nice, but I like soundtracks to movies because they are meant to move a story along. They're meant to help tell a story. And so if I find a soundtrack that I particularly like, or if it creates a feeling in me, well, then I keep on listening to it over and over until I drive even the cats crazy. But I try to distill it into this idea that's in my head.
I've started making playlists for my artist on the comic that I'm writing now. It's the Vietnam War comic. And so I put together a bunch of, I guess, period songs that would kind of fit the mood I'm trying to evoke. So it's a lot of like Stooges and the Doors, like some of the crazier door stuff. But I love having that ability. You go onto Spotify or something and throw something together.
Yeah. Don't make it though just for that era. Look for something that speaks to you. You know, like, for instance, that you might find a character or a character that you're working on and might show up in a piece of music from anywhere. It doesn't matter because you're not putting out a soundtrack. You know, so use whatever you need or whatever you can find. And something, again, the music speaks to you, and then you can use that to speak to others.
That reminds me, my wife and I were talking last night about have you seen the show Lovecraft Country?
No, I haven't.
Oh my goodness, it's amazing. I think you would appreciate it. But it's set in the 50s, but the music they use is from all over. But it fits like, you know, it fits like it should be there. It's like a puzzle. It goes right into it, and it's amazing. So yeah, I totally get the soundtrack thing. Do you mind if we talk about the Spectre a little bit?
No, sure, by all means.
So with the heavy themes in your work, how did you deal with the juxtaposition of like the metaphysical ideas in the Spectre with such a salt of the earth, everyman type medium? And like, further, have you had any problems from your editorial team and with them just going like, no, just please make the guy hit the other guy. Like, that's all we want from you.
No, well, actually the editor and DC in general were very supportive of what we're doing. So long as Tom and I had to convince them that we knew what we were doing and that they should give the character to us. People were saying, well, yeah, but the Spectre is so powerful, you can only do about 8 to 10 issues, maybe a year, because either you have to downgrade his powers or you won't be able to do a whole lot with it. And
it's kind of the same problem that Superman has in a way. He's too powerful sometimes.
Yeah. But Tom and I said, no, look, you got to have those visuals in there, you know, because that's what makes him the Spectre. That's what makes him different than Superman. You know, it's these insane visuals. You know, he's equal to God, and God had better be eating his Wheaties, you know, in terms of what he can do to people, you know, and do to reality. We said, we know what the specter should be and how to do it. Give them to us and we'll show you. And to DC's credit, and it was initially Dan Rasper and then Peter Tomasi, who were our editors, we had complete support. And one thing that was interesting also about it was that as we got up and, you know, as we approached the end of the run, we were told, well, look, your overall numbers are going down. It'll probably be canceled in about a year. So take your time now and figure out how you want to end it. And so they gave us time to work to our ending, which we had a big idea even from the start. And so it enabled us, and they let us do what we wanted for our ending. And that made the entire run a single story, because it was about how Jim Corrigan, and our focus in the book was Jim Corrigan more than on the Spectre. Spectre was there, you know, for the pizzazz, but it was Jim Corrigan who was going to change.
Oh, yeah. So when you look at that character now and what they're doing, does it bother you when you see different interpretations? Is it kind of like seeing an old girlfriend you used to date? Or do you even keep up with it?
I don't keep up with it. Generally, when I leave a book, I don't look at it again unless, say, they pop me in for fill-in or something like that. Mainly because, excuse me, I have the chance to do what I wanted without other people looking over my shoulder. And, you know, Firestorm is a good example. Jerry Conway didn't bother me with it at all. I don't think he read any of mine. And that's fine by me. You know, people who come in to create The Spectre or Suicide Squad or anything else, they have the right to do their creative thing without wondering what I might think of it. Well, I won't have an opinion on it because I'm not reading it.
Yeah, yeah. I can understand not wanting to see anything once you're done with it. And especially since you guys kind of wrapped it up and said your piece.
Yeah.
So you moved from the Spectre to Suicide Squad, right?
Or was I was doing Suicide Squad before the Spectre.
Oh my goodness.
Suicide Squad actually spun out of Legends. That's where it first appeared.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Gold. I had already sold the idea of Suicide Squad to Bob Greenberger. And Mike suggested that we launch it in Legends because Legends was going to, you know, have a wide audience. And so that might enable us to take some of that audience and put it in the squad when it spun out from it.
So there's a lot of talk lately about the upcoming Suicide Squad movie. And
yeah.
The director of the film has kind of talked about your work in particular as being the inspiration behind his film. Mm-hmm. Do you have any insight as to what's going on? I'm not going to ask you anything that shouldn't be said, but do you think that they're kind of, they've got the spirit of what you're doing?
I don't know much what's going on, but I have a lot of faith, particularly from what James Gunn has said outside of doing it. He shows a lot of respect for what I did, and he understands why I did what I did. He gets it. And so I have a lot of hope and a lot of expectation. And he's such a good filmmaker to begin with. You know, like, so this could be a really fun movie. And I hope the movie theaters open up because I really want to see it on the biggest screen I can.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's I think it's going to be a while before things start getting better. But then again, I mean, I don't think they're going to be hitting theaters with it anytime soon, especially with... They keep moving other films back, so there's going to be such a backlog.
I know. Well, the new Squad movie isn't due out until August of next year, so I'm hoping that by then the movie theaters are open again, if only because I love going to the movies in movie theaters anyway. But I hope that by that point that they can get it in there and that it'll be open to, you know, and the public can go in and see what they're doing.
So when you put together this team, did you have any directives from anyone as to who you could not use and who you could? Or did you just go, this is my team, just let me have these guys and you won't hear from me, I won't bother you?
Well, there were some characters that I wanted in and that I put in. Amanda Waller was a new character, so I controlled her. Basically, my thing was that I wanted characters that I, you know, if you're going to let me use it, then I then I want to have some control over them. That's why the Joker didn't appear in the squad when I was writing it. Bob Greenberger mentioned a couple of characters that he thought would be good. He wanted us to use Captain Boomerang. First, I said, oh, God, he's such a silly character. I mean, look at that costume. It's like he's wearing, you know, like a soda jerk's cap on his head. But Bob went out, and I started working it. And I should mention that there is this series of novels, historical novels, by the writer George MacDonald Fraser, about a character called Flashman. Flashman was originally in a well-known boys' book back at the turn of the previous century called Tom Brown's School Days. And Flashman is a lout, and he's a drunk, and he's a bully at the school, and he gets kicked out of the school, and the story. Well, George MacDonald Fraser picked him up from that point and didn't change him at all. He just continued to let him be a lout and a lecher, a coward, and just the biggest anti-hero that you can imagine. And so I sort of took that concept and said, okay, that's what we're going to do with Captain Boomerang. And Captain Boomerang wound up being one of my favorite characters in the squad. You know, just when you think he's gone he's dipped as far down as he can, he finds another level to sink to. And so as a result, I had great deal of fun. Although it's funny, I wanted to make him Australian or more Australian than he was. So I had gotten a bunch of books and dictionaries about Australian slang until my friend Dave DeVries, who's Australian, came over and we talked about it. He told me, "All right, mate, you know, whenever we get a new issue out, me and my mates get together and we read Captain Boomerang aloud and we have a good laugh." But no, this is legit stuff. I got it out of a book. And he says, "Well, maybe, mate, but no one talks like that." And I said, "All right." So I toned it down and he helped me correct some of the things. So he still had an Australian twang, but not quite as indecipherable as I sometimes made him.
That's hilarious. It makes me, I have a friend who, he does indie comics and his artist is in, I think, the Philippines. But in the script, he put a note that somebody pulls out a switchblade, and the artist in the Philippines had no idea what a switchblade was. So he looked it up and Googled it, and he turns in the art, and on the page, it was a switchblade comb instead of a switchblade knife. So the the things got kind of mixed up and like, well, technically you're correct, but you know, nobody's going to try to stab somebody with a switchblade comb.
Yeah. Never bring a comb to a knife fight.
Exactly. There's one thing that Indiana Jones has taught us.
Yeah.
So writing characters who are kind of scumbags, was it hard for you to envision just how low they could go? Let me rephrase this. Was it hard for you to make them redeemable?
Well, I mean, first, let's be honest. You know, like, writing scumbags is part of my forte. It's part of my stock and trade. You know, and as my partner Mary Mitchell has said, these people are in you somewhere, John. You know, so which is why, you know, like, sometimes when somebody wants to create an argument with me, I go, "Are you crazy? I write Suicide Squad." Grimjack comes from me, you know, you don't mess. So, and I don't know, for some reason, I just like those characters better. Any person is a mixture of good and bad. And so, you know, you play the opposite. And so if they're supposed to be a bad character, you find some things that are redeeming characteristics. I mean, I'm sure even Trump has some. Oh, excuse me, I got political.
Hey, get as political as you want. It is fine with me. I'm struggling to find a positive character. That's the thing. I hated Bush. I hated GW, but I still would have gladly had a beer with him.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if I would flick a booger at Trump.
Oh, right. No. I might throw a beer in his face, but basically, my thing is, and this is part of the thing that I do in characterization, I look for the opposites. You know, this is an exercise that I've done in some of my classes or some of my presentations at cons. And take a sheet of paper, and on one side, write characteristics. For instance, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, brave, clean, and reverent. You know, like in a line from top to bottom. then draw a line in the center of the page, and then opposite each characteristic of this Boy Scout, write what's the opposite of it. And you can't use words like unfriendly. No, you got to be a little more creative than that. And so you go down the line and you find all of that and make it the best, the most interesting opposite that you can. And I guarantee you, if everything on the left-hand side is true, and it is, because it is for everyone, everything on the right-hand side will be true, because it is for everyone. And you have to find a way to do that. And what it means is that one moment they're this thing, another moment they're the other thing. We as humans go back and forth, you know, all the time. You know, like one panel, nice person, next panel, shit. You know, so that's, and don't try to explain it, just show it. You leave room for the reader to put it all together.
When you're writing this stuff, and you say just show it, and that I'm sure that's a lot of also working well with the artist, but in having faith in the artist's abilities to do the showing part. When you're writing someone that is, you know, not you, that is quite different from you, what helps you to get that voice out? Specifically, like with Amanda Waller, you don't have the experiences that a middle-aged Black woman has.
That's because I'm not writing a Black character. I'm writing a character who's Black, and that's different. I don't have the Black experience, but I can find something in her that is like me. And that is true of any character that you want to write. For one Suicide Squad story, we had a character called William Heller, who was an out-and-out racist. You're like, well, you know, that's not where I go, but I have to find that inside of me. You know, it's all inside of you. You're like, everything that you could possibly want to write is inside of you. You know, you just have to find an equivalent. It doesn't have to be exact. For instance, say about killing someone. Well, hopefully you don't have to kill someone in order to find out how that feels, but say that if you've ever killed a fly, well, okay, maybe that's how this character feels about killing someone. On the other hand, if you have ever done something or said something that killed a relationship, and I mean past recovery, you know, no amount of apologies will do it. If you've ever done something like that, and every person I've ever met has, well, maybe that's how your character feels about killing someone. Again, this comes out from my theater days. In order to play a character, I have to find out where that character is inside of me. And it's not an exact one-to-one. It's how do I feel? How does the character feel? Again, if I had to write Trump, I'd have to get into a line of thought whereas I feel perfectly justified in what I'm doing, that it's all about me. Well, have I ever had moments like that? Yeah, everyone has. And that's important too, because that's what you're selling to the reader. If you haven't felt it in you, what you're doing is trying to find that in your reader as well. It's, you know, that's what is the big thing about telling a good story. You want to draw the reader in. You want them to feel this. You know, like you want to take them through an experience. So by the end of it, they go, yeah, that was a good read.
I like that. And do you have any tips for ending things on a good note to make people want to come back?
A tragedy can be entertaining. That's famous acting teacher Konstantin Stanislavski said in one of his books. Even a tragedy should be entertaining. It should take you into it, you know, so that you willingly go along with it, so that you feel what the characters feel, and then you come out on the other side. The idea of tragedy is that you come out purged. You know, you have lived through something without actually having to physically live through it. So that's what you're looking to do with your stories. You know, is to bring them through an experience. You know, that speaks to them. I don't write just for myself. You know, I write so the readers can connect with it, so that I connect with the reader. So there's like this electrical current that goes back and forth between us. If I do that, then I've done my job.
I like that a lot. What do you do when it's just not working? When you, the last thing you want to do is sit behind that computer or whatever you use to do your work and write a script?
It's happened. I've had points where I'm blocked, where I have writer's block. It happens. Writer's block doesn't last. And if I'm blocked on one story, I generally try to have two or three stories going at the same time. So that if something doesn't work over here, I can go over there. And then I take the plot that isn't working, just shove it into my subconscious and let it kind of ferment there until it offers some sort of solution. Usually I'm trying to work something too hard or I'm not seeing what the real solution is, or I'm fighting it. And if writing isn't working at all, go out, make the bed, wash the dishes, play with the dog, play with the cats, go watch a movie, you listen to some music, especially listen to music, read something, you know, get your mind off it. Don't make a big thing about it. It'll come back. You have to trust in it and that it will come back.
What gets you excited about getting back behind the word processor and putting in a day's work?
Well, it's not always the word processor. When I do my notes, I generally have a journal, and I like to write in the journal because sometimes it feels like the thoughts and the feelings come out and go down my arm and into the pen and into the ink, then onto the page. So I often spend time on that, and that's good too because that gets me out from behind the computer. And the nice thing about journals, I can take it anywhere.
I was about to say, yeah, you can go to a park and on a sunny day and go to town.
Yeah, and it could be anything. Like, I mean, do you like a yellow pad? Use a yellow pad. Do you like a small notebook? Fine, use that. Whatever works for you. You know, there's only one way to write, and that's whatever way works for you.
My productivity in writing has increased exponentially since I figured out a way to do it on my cell phone, which is I feel like it's such a goofy thing to write a full script on your phone. But I work a full time job and I have two kids, so
it's whatever works.
Exactly, it's the time that I have when I'm not. Dad, can you do this? Dad, I'm hungry. Dad, or you know, hey, get back to work.
Yeah. You know, I used to, when I was working at a day job, you know, like a survival job, I would take it would usually be downtown Chicago and I was living on the north side. So I'd get the L and I'd have my journal and I'd write in the journal as I went. Or if I'm going on a trip, you know, if it's by train or plane, I have my journal with me and I can write while I'm trying. So long as I have my journal, I can work anywhere.
So speaking of work, do you have anything coming up that we need to know about?
Well, Jan Dersima, who I did so many Star Wars stories with, she and I have a character that she dreamed up called Hexer Dusk. And we have one graphic novel of that finished. It's just come off the printer, and we had a Kickstarter. And so when Jan gets it, she's going to start mailing them out. Hopefully we still have a post office. We're going to start mailing them out to the people who subscribed to it. So that right now it exists as a PDF for those who subscribed as well. So it is out there. And we're working on a second story with that.
Oh, nice. Did you like that process? Was that your first time doing a crowdfunding effort?
It's a lot of work. You learn just what a publisher brings to the table when it all falls, you know, to you. And Jan took Jan did just about all the work on it. I got to be honest, it all came back down to her. And she researched the printers and got it off to the printers, got it ready for the printers. And she did the lettering and the color and the coloring as well as the art. And we plotted it out together. So it may not be for everybody, but it is a way of getting your work out there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's in riding the wave of Kickstarter as you're watching those numbers tick up and hopefully tick up. And the last, you know, 2 weeks are the most god-awful experience ever. You feel like you're adrift in the middle of a waveless ocean. And the winds have abandoned you, or at least that's my experience. Hopefully you didn't have that.
No, it's tough. You know, you're asking people to put money down on something that they aren't going to see right away. Hexer Dusk has taken a couple of years to get out, and you try to think that it won't, but it does. You know, by the time you get all the work done and on out. So it's interesting. You get very interesting work, I think, out of it. You get stuff that is not filtered through a company and whatever they might want or think that they don't want. You know, it's very cool. Tom Mandrake and I did a book as well called Cross, K-R-O-S, Hallowed Ground, where we combined Civil War and vampires. That's complete, and that's out there. And anybody who liked our work on Spectre might like that as well. For those who like Jan's and my work on Star Wars, this isn't Star Wars, but it is set in a sort of space opera-y sort of level.
So with the way that people are going to these crowdfunding things, do you think that that's the way the entire industry is going to be heading?
I have no idea. Will there even be comic book stores after all of this is over? We've seen DC radically cut its staff and change things. And they're even, you know, I cut a lot of their books out. You know, what is the industry going to look like, say, a year from now? Who knows? Well, who knows what the movie industry or the television industry is going to look like? Restaurants, bars, you know, everything. You know, like, this is a big event and comparable, certainly, to the Second World War, to the Depression, to the First World War, to the Civil War. Things that radically changed society. What we're going through now in terms of Trump, that's going to radically change who we are. You know, we're being exposed to things about who we are right now. And some of it is not so nice. And we're going to have to face that and confront that and see if we can resolve it.
Yeah.
So these are, you know, the Chinese say, may you live in interesting times. These are interesting times.
Oh, yeah. It scares the hell out of me. And I have, like I said earlier, I have two small kids, and I'm really, really worried about the world that they're going to inherit, especially given that we have a leader that does not respect women, or, you know, the world that he leaves behind, as long as, and I apologize for going political.
No, I think one of the things that we do, particularly when we write, and we write science fiction and we write fantasy, is that we're dealing with speculative fiction, with what is it going to look like. If you want a piece of work that is going to speak to people, then you want to write something that is going to reflect the reality they're living in, or if you can predict it, going to live in. And that's very tough. And it's not only political, it's also environmental. You know, the wildfires, which are going to substantially change the West Coast, you're going to get a bunch of people who are going to be refugees from that heading east. You've got hurricanes. There's still hurricanes coming up.
Yeah, coming up this weekend. Yeah, because we get the dregs of that. You know, just being in central Alabama, it'll come right up through the state, and it's no fun. We get the tornadoes too. So
yeah, it's late in the year too for them. You know, but this may be the new normal. You know, what's going to continue to happen? You know, how's this going to affect food production? How's this going to affect manufacturing? There are all sorts of changes coming up very quickly on it. In terms of the political thing, over and above Trump, you've got 40% who are his hardcore followers.
And even sick offense.
And after he goes, they're going to still be there.
Exactly. I was telling somebody this the other day is, you know, if we get him out of the office, that mindset still exists. They're not going to all of a sudden go, oh, we were so silly for you know, following this guy. No, they're still going to persist. They're still, you know, the call is coming from inside the house as far as these people are concerned. They're still in government.
Yeah, well, not only in government, but also, you know, in the population.
Yeah.
And he didn't create them. He simply revealed them, gave them permission to speak out, you know, what they have always been thinking and feeling. They were always there, and they're going to be there. And there are some of them on both sides are talking about the possibility of another civil war. I don't necessarily believe that, but a cultural civil war, yeah, we're seeing that now. You know, there are those who think that he would have no problems with seeing liberal shot.
So given all that, and with respect for your time, because I don't want to keep you on too long, what gives you hope?
What do I hope?
No. What gives you hope right now, given that things are admittedly kind of bleak?
I hope that some of what I expect to see, that I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. I want to be wrong.
You and me both, brother. John Ostrander, thank you so much for talking to us, man. It's been a pleasure. I admittedly was very nervous coming into this because I've respected you and your work for a while, and I've stumbled like an idiot a few times. So I apologize for that. But thank you so much for talking to me.
You were fine. Yeah, it was fun.
Thank you again. And when we post this up, I'll tag you in the social media. Although you're not active on the hellhole known as Twitter, I see that you're on Facebook. So
I'll put up on Facebook.
I hear you. So John Ostrander, thank you again, and have a good evening, man.
You too. And be safe and be well.
Same to you. Yeah, wash your hands, mask up, and stay safe. And we'll get through all this.
And we're back, man. What do you think? That was really cool. John was a great guy. I was able to listen to most of the interview live and chat a little bit with him. And he was super cool guy. Then I said I had to drop out. And I'm sorry, Casey. He had to do the last half of the interview. So, you know, he was running the whole thing anyways. And Casey did a great job. If you haven't noticed, in most interviews that I'm on with somebody else, I usually just sit in the background and listen and take notes because I find that fun. But John was great. He had a lot of great answers to the questions that we asked. And we had a good time with him. And I'd love to have him come back on and talk about more stuff. But if you like that, if you like what you heard today, go over to Spoilerverse.com, check out all of our back issues. And while you're there, check out all of our other shows, like Bridging the Geekdoms, Nerds from the Crypt, Haphazard Adventures, where we are posting a beer a day episode, which I just chugged a beer, so I'm feeling really good right now. And so we just record that episode. It's awesome. And other shows you have there, like if you want to hear two young ladies talk about movies and comics and what they did for the day, go check out Super Awesome Sisters Show. It's my two daughters, and they record and edit and do it all themselves. So you're going to hear some really weird stuff if you check it out, but it's a lot of fun. But, you know, do all that and go check out all the articles and reviews and previews we post there on the daily. Check out our store, get a t-shirt or a hoodie or a face mask, look fly yourself, help support the site and all that we do here that we provide to you for free. If you buy something, we get a little dollar or two for that and it helps pay for the stuff. And lastly, go to scpod.us/discord and join our public Discord. And that way you can come and chat with us. You can talk to everybody involved. You can be involved in the questions we ask and help, you know, shape the show. Maybe you have an idea of somebody we should talk to, somebody we don't know about, or somebody we just haven't thought about yet. You can come to Discord and tell us. And, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. We can talk to them. Maybe you have an idea and you want to come talk to us. You never know. So join that again, scpod.us/Discord, and come say hi. And last thing on the show I'm going to do for you, you know we do it every time. You know, I know you love it because we love it. It's In an Ocean's Up podcast, we are Cthulhu. And as Cthulhu compels you to do, open the mind and re-enter the mind.